November 2006, and I'm here with Don Miles, and we'll be discussing NORAD. So I wanted to thank you, Don, for taking the time of sitting down with me and having a chat. So we'll go ahead and begin. So what years did you begin to work with NORAD Command, and where were you stationed?
Well, the first time was in 1980. I was transferred from Ottawa, where I was in the National Defense Headquarters. I was transferred to 25th NORAD Region, which is at McCord Air Force Base in Washington, which is beside the city of Tacoma, and that's sort of south of Seattle on the Puget Sound. And I was the assistant deputy for operations there. That was a co-headquarters, 25th NORAD Region, 25th Air Division for the U.S. on the national side. So if it was a national business, the Air Division handled it, even though it was probably the same person that I worked with as who I worked for in NORAD. It was like everybody was twin-hatted. Not the Canadians as such, but because of association, really, there was no big dividing line between the 25th Air Division and the 25th NORAD. We worked both ways. When it got into, say, Air Force personnel or Canadian personnel issues, then we would work with Canadians from the NORAD side, and the U.S. would work theirs from the Air Division side, just as a way to separate.
So the 25th NORAD Division then was supplying information rapidly to the 25th U.S. Air Force Division, is that correct?
Well, we were just co-located, same guy. I worked for a U.S. colonel, and he was the deputy for operations for the 25th NORAD Region. He was also the DO for the 25th Air Division, which is the U.S. side of it. But we worked together, the information all came into the same computers from the radar sites, and we processed it, and then we used it for the air defense of the region, and also it was shipped to the other regions and to Colorado Springs.
Okay. And then, so were you still dealing with the D-Line at this time, or have the New North Warning System come in here?
No, it was still the D-Line. But we really didn't have any direct control or information from them. That information, the DEW line, would go to Colorado Springs into the big computer down there, and then we would get warnings of things coming. But the DEW line was, by that time, was looking more at missile defense than airplanes, although the Russians were still digging around. You know, they kept floating them over every so often just to see what response they got out of it.
Right. And you take this information coming from Colorado Springs. What were your duties and responsibilities at the NORAD station in Washington?
Well, if it was dealing with our region, then it's a geographical region, and essentially we have the British Columbia, state of Washington, and east. The next region to the east of us was at Great Falls, Montana, so somewhere between Great Falls and McCord was the dividing line, the north-south line. And if there was any threat coming into our region, then we could activate the fighter force to investigate what it was.
How much of a concern were sub-launched air cruise missiles, especially on the West Coast, for you, just being in charge of DC?
They were... The SLBMs were, I wouldn't say new, but certainly they were of concern, because they were probably the worst you could get, because the subs could probably get in. It could be missed a lot easier than an airplane coming in. And if they got in, they could pop up and launch and be back up before we do much better, although we go after the cruise missile, because they're not that fast. So if you've got time, if you launched 100 miles off, you may have time to catch it before it gets in. But they are relatively slow, but still they're fast enough that you can miss them.
And would an air-launched cruise missile be more common of a threat that you would be concerned with, especially with the variation in development?
I'm just trying to think. They were still using the old Bears. And I can't recall whether they were hanging cruise missiles on them or not. I know some of one of the newer bombers was coming in, and they were carrying a high-speed missile that it could launch. And of course, if he got in within range, well, then it would just go game over, because we really didn't have anything that was going to catch up to the fast rocket-powered type missile.
And as you said, the cruise missiles were, some of them were at a slower speed. What equipment did you have to intercept these, and how adequate was your equipment for this operation?
Well, if it was a sub-launched or a cruise missile as such, I guess really there's a difference between cruise missile and a high-speed missile. The cruise missile is jet-powered, so it's relatively slow. Still, we're talking in terms of probably 300-400 miles an hour. So he poops right along. If we catch him immediately, then we would use the fighters that we have. McCourt has squadron fighters, and of course we had fighters up at Comox. And that was our main part. And then we had guard fighters at Portland and down at Kingsley, which is further down the coast, just on the California border. So that gave us the West Coast cover, and that's what we would use.
And in Comox, it wasn't still the F-101, was it?
Yeah, it was in 1980, until quite a while after that, before we got the F-18s come in. But then, that's getting into the later on in the 90s, or in the late 80s, when the F-18s were available, and of course they were never stationed at Comox. They would come and stand alert from Cold Lake. So
they were roughly about 20 year old technology then in Comox.
The old Rudeus.
They came in with Kennedy, right?
So. Yeah, well, actually before then, the 101s, they still had the missile, the atomic warheads on the missile for the 101s. So they had a U.S. attachment at Comox that looked after the missiles, which they never passed control of the nuclear, the warhead, over to other nations until release was given. And that's really an infallible. Same as what we did in Europe, but in Europe for years, we had nuclear weapons. It was always a U.S. detachment that owned the missile, or owned the warheads, the bomb.
So, when you received information from Colorado Springs of an unidentified object or an aircraft or something that doesn't match the flight trajectory plan, what steps did you then personally have to take, and where were you in the line of dispatching a response unit to that?
Well, if the only time we would get that information from Colorado Springs is if it came through the north or the new line system and triggered something, and NORAD would get that, and then they would notify us that there was something coming. And later on, once it got into our range of coverage, if it was coming to our area, well, then it became our responsibility. And as soon as if it was a bomber, talking about bombers pretty well now, we would then, at the appropriate time, launch our fighters. Don't launch them too early, because we can see maybe further than what they can go and get back, so you have to take the time that they go catch them and do something about them and still get back home. So if it was coming from the north, Comox would probably be the first guys. If it was coming more from down south, coming from out of the Pacific, well, then of course, McCord or the guards down at Portland or Kingston. And they had 106s at McCord, which was an old fighter, but it had good range. And also during that period of time, they re-equipped with the F-15, which was far superior, although it didn't carry the nuclear rocket, which is maybe a blessing because I don't know much about it, but they always used to call it a blivet. It was something that you threw Adam, and it wasn't particularly accurate, but of course it had a big warhead, so it didn't have to be super accurate.
So for yourself, did you feel as though you were always in this, have to be in a state of constant readiness to deploy or to send people?
Well, it wouldn't be so much deploying, although unless it was a one, you know, things were really getting hot, like say a pre-war situation where you want to disperse your fighters to different bases, then you would be getting people ready to go. As the headquarters, we planned on basically staying where we were, and then we were starting plans to have a mobile segment go up, but we didn't really have that working well, or were even testing on it at the time I was there. What it would be is case if the DO was home, Director of Operations, he was the U.S. Colonel at that point, he was really in charge, and then eventually, things were really getting warm, of course he would call the general, and whether it was the U.S. general or the Canadian general, it didn't matter, it's whoever was in charge that day. If one was away, the other had it, there was no differentiation between the two. And if my colonel was away, well then I would take his place, and I was always in, would always be in direct radio contact with the ops room upstairs, which were the people sitting there watching the radar screens for things coming in, and they would also direct the intercepts if it got to that state. We always had a lot of unknowns, you know, it was somebody stoozing around. Usually you didn't bother with them, and it was slower than, I think we used 150 miles an hour or something. I think it was 115. Well, we assumed it was some kid out lost in the Cessna 170 or something like that. Didn't worry about it too much. Unless it was obvious maybe he really was lost and we should try and help him find where he is. But if it was faster than that, well, then we generally would always launch fighters off to see when it was.
And how often in, let's say, a month would you deploy fighters to just respond? I mean, it might not necessarily be.
Probably two or three times a month. It also use it as training. You know, you don't hesitate because you go out and see what it is, or even if you're pretty sure you know what it is, you probably still want to send them out because it's good practice for the crews. They need the flying time, and you test the procedure.
And for yourself personally, like when you have these unidentified objects coming in, was that an extremely stressful scenario for you? Did you always have to take the stance that could be a Soviet threat coming in?
Well, you did, but you have to realize, you know, if it's only one unknown, it's probably not very serious. You know, you'd have to assume that if the Russians were going to do something, they're going to do it in a big way. They're not going to peer around with, one airplane. Because they had the strength to do it. And also with the fact that the number of missiles. Both sides have. Really, the missiles were going to be the first things, because you're not going to send out a bomber to stir up the hornet's nest and then send your missiles in later. So send the missiles in, and they'll probably take out everything and use your bombers to clean up if there's nothing left.
Right. So, in your time in Washington, what would you say your primary concern was then?
Really, I think more to ensure that all the people, both the radar people upstairs in the room, doing the watching the radars, and the fighter squadrons, that they were all well trained and knew exactly what they had to do if they had to do it. And essentially, it's a training process.
Good. Great. I'd like to move on to your time now at Colorado Springs, and particularly I want to look at, so when you were at Colorado Springs, did you witness the deployment of the new North Warning System?
No. I don't even remember what year that actually came to be, and I think they were still working on it. Do you have the dates?
85, I believe, is when it became operational.
It became operational. Well, and that was the time I was there. It essentially did not have any effect on the job that I was doing at that time. I was the deputy in the backup, the buffers we call the backup facility. And that was if the main center went down in the mountain, if something happened, if they had a power failure or whatever, and they went off the air, then this backup facility, which was down on Peterson Field above ground, would take over. And we had a very small organization. We ran it 24/7 all the time. We had a crew there 24 hours a day, and it was six-man crew. And their job was to basically track in a broad form the information that the mountain had, what was going on. They couldn't do everything because we didn't have the computer capacity or anything like that to have a full picture, but a broad picture. And then if the mountain went down, we would take over as the command center. Of course, immediately that happened, well, then the generals started piling in, and they set up shop in the backup facility, because it was ran by a U.S. Army colonel, strangely enough, and myself as a deputy. So we were outrun pretty quickly as soon as something happened.
Right.
Which they would try to conduct the operations for NORAD as best they could with a very limited capability.
And this backup facility would be reliant on what system?
We were getting information basically from the same sources, but we didn't have the display capability like all the radar stations for operators to sit there and direct. Yes, and we were essentially a command center that the direction of the fighters would be left to somebody else, because we really didn't have the communications or any of the radar equipment.
Was there times where you would have practice scenarios of, obviously, the main operational center going down and you taking over that scene? How would that carry out?
Well, we would, yes, we ran exercises basically almost on a weekly basis, sometimes oftener than that, just for training for our own crews. And it was a case to demonstrate that we could pass information that the main center had gone down to Washington, D.C. actually. The president is the guy who can, the only guy who can release, say, the missiles. And that was the big thing, the key. You know, you're not worried so much about the airplanes, because that's, say, the missiles are going to come first. And if there was a launch detected from the satellites, launch detected of a missile launch in the UK or in the USSR, then it would go to the mountain, but if the mountain was gone, it would come to us, and then we would then direct it to Washington, and eventually, you know, it would get to the point that if there was massive, well, then the president was going to be the end of the point. And he would be the guy who would say, yes, launch, and then the message would go out to all the missiles.
When Harry's wears the multiple hats, which seems to be a big issue of him being in charge of Space Command and seeing more of that, and United States Air Force Space Command, did you see that as a unified way to respond to a missile as well as air threat then?
Yeah, it was the only way that could be done. Excuse me. Actually, it was when I was there that U.S. Space Command was formed. And they came and set up headquarters in Colorado Springs at the same location. And of course, the SYNC was SYNC Space, SYNC NORAD, SYNC U.S. Space Command, you know, he had a lot of hats. Doing the same job, essentially, in all of them, although in the space, well, then you're more into the missile business. Yes, the Canadian could do that, but they would really prefer that it would be the U.S. band at the time.
When NORAD then takes on the name, which I think is a bit earlier than we were talking about, of aerospace surveillance as well, in addition to air surveillance, can you comment on NORAD's capabilities of surveillance of missiles?
Same as what? U.S. space had, because it was all the same sensors. They were putting information into the same pot. They didn't. There was, when you get the satellites, that's the satellites became the low of touch here, because even though I knew from my position in NORAD, I knew what most of the satellites were, I also knew there were other satellites up there that I didn't know about. And what they actually did, I'm not sure. Essentially, not much different than the ones I did know about. But they had this little, you know, what we call it, game. It was just protecting their information. And the less people that know about it, the better. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's good. Because if I couldn't do anything about it with the information from those, I didn't want to know about it, because it's none of my business. And there were many satellites up there that I don't know about. I'm not sure. I suspect our desync, as we call the Canadian at Colorado Springs, I think that he knew all of them. I think our senior general, one general worked in operations, and one worked in plans. I think they knew all of them too. But it's what they call compartmented information, and you're cleared for a compartment. This is over and above what we call the CTS, atomic, cosmic top secret, including atomic information, which is generally the top classification. But over and above that, then there's these compartments. And sometimes you're cleared for one compartment or many compartments, others you're not cleared for any.
Would NORAD have any responsibility of tracking a missile upon reentry? Or it didn't have the capabilities to do that?
The information that came into the command center in the mountain, that's where that sort of information would be, and the crews were mixed, Canadian, U.S. The command director, they call him the NORAD command director, but essentially he was working for NORAD Space Command.
So there's a lot of personnel then wearing multiple hats and all to make everything efficient. Then, when Reagan starts to develop, or when SDI and the Nike is launched by the Americans, a lot of people see that intimately linked with NORAD. Would that be because NORAD's part of this huge information system which would direct a missile defense that would be developed?
Well, You know, the SDI, looking at it from where I was sitting in NORAD, it really didn't mean that much. I mean, it was a program to enhance the defense, basically the U.S., so the only ones with the money to do it. But I didn't see that that was going to affect Canada in any great way. Some people get a little excited about the politicians, a little excited about something new that they don't understand. Still do, but with missile defense right at the present time. And I don't think the SDI, it was a lot of magic in that SDI, which of course they never really fulfilled it.
Right. But the political controversy just kind of arose out of a lack of knowledge and understanding of a NORAD command structure.
The information was all there, you know, that any of the politicians that were interested could have found out exactly, you know, the position of NORAD vis-a-vis Space Command and how SDI fitted in. But many politicians won't take the time to try and understand it because it probably goes against their dogma. And that's not good, according to them. It's unfortunate. Politicians will believe what they want to believe, not necessarily what's true and what's not.
So, how familiar were you with the North Warning System and its capabilities?
Really, from my perspective or my position, really not familiar with it at all, other than it was just sort of an updated do line, essentially. And, you know, it provided essentially the same type of information, probably with better equipment and things like that. But other than that, I didn't know, and I really had no real desire to.
Okay. Do you think the removal of the Mid-Canada line would it affect you at all? Because once a missile or plane, not a cruise missile or a plane passed, the North Warning System or previously the Dew Line, and then the Canada Line was removed, there was no tracking system. So did that affect you in any way? I mean, you can only work with what you were given, right?
That's right. And when they start shutting down the radar stations, which I had one of them, I commanded one of the radar stations. It was in the middle that was shut down, and really the whole interior of the continent became a big black hole almost. The U.S. then started to put in an east and west system of radars, the name of them.
OTHBs.
Yeah, or OTHBs on the east and west side. That covered up a lot, but of course, as you say, if something got inside, it's going to be pretty hard to track them. Now, I don't know if the Russians have the capability, other than, as you say, SLBMs. The thing that, where I would see that the SLBMs would be used mainly along the coast, not too far in, and that they could be launched from the Atlantic or Pacific, so getting in behind the radar system. We always had a perimeter system of radar along the coast, like Holbert was always going, radar site out in Macaw, out here in the tip of Washington, and further down south on the coast of the U.S., like the perimeter, always had a coverage, and the East Coast also. In Canada, it's pretty thin up in the north there, but I'm not too sure how that covered. Our coverage was extent really Comox and as far as Holbert radar. As far as it could go, that would be the West Coast coverage, and then the last that we could go with.
Did you you find an inadequacy on the coast, because the OHTVs seem to be the answer, but they never quite came into effect on the West Coast, and the E3s were supposed to be the big gap fillers. Did you find that the E3s were maybe an inadequate system because they weren't 24-hour operational systems?
Well, actually, they could be. They were good. There were no doubt. It was I've flown them many times, and well, it wasn't my favorite duty, because you go up on one of those things, like we would go down to their main base, down at Tinker in Oklahoma. So we'd fly a commercial down there and get on it, and we'd take off out of Tinker about 2 or 3 in the morning. This would be for an exercise, but it would be the same as if it was an actual emergency. Take off and come up and go out onto a position out off the coast here, probably about 200 miles, something like that. Close enough. And sit out there for a racetrack pattern. And you could sit there for, let's send a tanker up, give them more gas, go for another 7-8 hours. They could send another tanker if they want. They could. It would then become a crew problem as to how long a crew could go without coming in and some rest. But, you know, many times we would leave Tinker and not get back for about 14 hours or 15 hours. And that's with a couple of air refuelings. But at work, they watch is a good system. It really is.
So then would they only be deployed on knowledge of a upcoming threat, or when tensions got heated between East and West?
Yeah. Their home base was Tinker. Still is.
And you would be deployed on them when, or did you oversee operations on them, or were you part of the Canadian crew manning them?
No, I would go with, there would be a U.S., probably U.S. colonel and myself, and we'd go as the battle staff, which would take command of the crew if something happened to the command on the ground. Because in the AWACS, you have your own little surveillance section, about 9, 10, usually your junior officers. And they work all the radar, and then we would play the command function in the airplane, but really no command unless something happened to the command on the ground. It's like backup. Actually, very boring. Straight down and sit there, fly for hours and hours and hours.
What was there a feeling of uneasiness and tension when you're up there for 3 or 4 days?
Well, the longest I ever was up trip, and it was always an exercise. It was never a actual emergency type situation. It was about 14, 16 hours. But it's just another day at the office, really.
Right.
It was very great training for the crews, both the radar people, but also the front end, the pilots, the crew chief up front there. That was they'd take off out of Tinker and they'd hit a tanker somewhere, the tanker on the West Coast here. Middle of the night, didn't matter, get there, get fuel, go, sit out for 6-7 hours, start heading back to Tinker, hit the tanker again, didn't have to, the fuel would be, we had enough fuel, but again, part of the thing. So they put in a good day's work, and so did the people running the radar. And the battle staff, as such, like myself, and the Air Force Colonel. A little boring.
That's okay, you can say that. I've read of a couple times in Colorado Springs where they did practice runs, but there was times when it happened that it wasn't, they didn't necessarily turn on the practice switch. Did anything like that ever happen to you where you were startled or thought an attack was actually coming?
No, not any time I was there, but I know there was the one time, it was quite a few years before, where they thought, I think it was, might have been during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that the U.S. general was away and it was the Canadian general that was in charge. And it got pretty tense. Other than that, I don't remember the details, but that was one of the close ones where they thought they didn't know what was happening.
So, particularly in your latter years with NORAD Command, and you see a diminishing Soviet political stance and maybe a diminishing. Did you ever view that the Soviet threat was diminishing, particularly in your last couple of years with NORAD, and did that impact your view of NORAD and the threat?
I think I left about a year or two early. I left there in summer of 87, and it was sort of 88, 89 when things really Soviet Union started to crumble, you might say.
So the threat was all
it was still essentially the same when I left as it had been for the previous 6-7 years that I spent down there. The change that I saw more was the in 86 when Space Command was formed and they came to Colorado Springs and set up their headquarters there, and again much of it was co-located with the Air Force and NORAD, but they decided they were going to take over their operation center was going to be what we called the BUC. And that meant, because that was Space Command, there wasn't any Canadians directly seconded to Space Command at that time. I think it's happened since, but at that time, no, Space Command was going to be pure U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. They all came in. And that was enlightening, because really the U.S. Navy and the Marines, many of them couldn't even spell NORAD, let alone know what it meant. When the Army colonel that I was working for, U.S. Army colonel, he was good because he was an artillery, i.e. missile, Army missile. He knew NORAD. He worked with NORAD for years. But he left, and the little U.S. Marine colonel, he really didn't know much about NORAD. He was a fast learner, but at the beginning, just a trouble spelling. And that was the whole function. So that didn't I didn't stay in Buck much longer than that, because he was beginning to set up the Space Command at the Condon Pops. So I was moved out of there, and I went out for the last year. Didn't really have much of a job.
So NORAD's a major Canadian operation, Canadian contribution, and like you said, they've been in it since 1956. So, I mean, can you give me some insight on how strong a role Canada played with NORAD for those that haven't heard about it or.
Well, from the point of the headquarters, I guess we filled a function down there. Our contribution to airplanes, like at Comox and on the East Coast, and that sort of went down, and then where we start, the radar stations getting shut down. Our contribution from that aspect really got pretty small.
So it was relying on U.S. equipment then?
Now, you know, when the F-18s came in, the plan was that they would home squad, the squadron would stay at Cold Lake when something happened, or they would just pull alerts and say two birds down there, and they would sit alert for a period of time. Or they could transfer the squadron, but that comes quite a production, you know, people and parts and all that sort of stuff. So it was a lot different than having the squadron sitting at Comox like they had before. Even though they were the old 101s, still wasn't a bad airplane, you know, for the bombers. Not as good as the 18, but still good.
Why was the Canadian military's role in NORAD mission? Was it strictly funding, or was it political, or was it a military aspect? Or?
Well, it was basically money. The budgets were going down. Save money, same as what happened over in Europe. When we at one time were sitting there with 12 squadrons, and when I left in 77, we had three. And that was all through the Trudeau era, and the Army was all moved out of, you know, money. Kept chiseling away at the budget, and decisions are made as to where they're going to save the money, and sometimes it makes you money.
Did you find at all that the NORAD role diminished as the Soviet missile threat increased? Because as you said, the Soviet missile threat would be primary attack, followed by a secondary wave of an air threat. Now, did you see Space Command taking over a former NORAD role, or overpowering NORAD in Colorado Springs?
Not really. The role... I suppose that Space Command may have been a result of, or part of the SDI. SDI may have been the impetus for Space Command formed. I'm not sure. That's getting into U.S. thinking. But Space Command, they were preoccupied totally with space. They weren't concerned about air breathing stuff at all. NORAD continued on and has continued on doing essentially the same job as what they've been doing for years, although, as I say, we don't have a heck of a lot of, we don't give much support to NORAD as far as equipment, north of the border, radars or airplanes. But then the U.S. have cut down on that too. You know, like there's no squadron at McCord anymore. That was taken away. Probably over 10 years ago now. Still have the guard and the Kingsland. So they still have some airplane, you know, on alert to do that type of work, but not as many as what used to. U.S. Guard squadrons have taken over a lot from the Red Corps.
As Canadian military personnel, what did you find NORAD provided?
Like provided to the personnel.
Provided on a larger picture, what did for Canadian defense and Canadian response to the threat?
Well, I think really NORAD did everything as far as air defense of North America. If we had tried to get the old 49s, and we worked north and they worked south, I don't think we would ever have had the system, warning system that we had. I don't think we would have ever been able to provide that ourselves. Certainly when you get up into the blue line, things like that, good money.
Right.
And even the mid-Canada line, you know, some of it was totally funded by it. Much of it was originally built by the U.S. and then other sites were totally Canadian. those U.S. sites, initially they were also manned by U.S., but then were turned over to Canada in the 50s. And that's where we manned them all in Canada, but many were built from the
U.S. And personally, what did NORAD do for you in regards to your contribution to the war effort? How did you do
your work? It was very interesting to be particularly at McCord in Washington here, and initially down in Colorado Springs to get back up the cell. It was interesting, and it was a good place for the work. Would never have had an opportunity to do that in Canada. We have other positions in Europe, but not in the air defense aspect, but there are sort of similar international positions in Europe. I spent a couple of years in SHAPE headquarters in Belgium, and that was the big headquarters. It certainly it gave as a voice, let's see, in what was going on and how we could think.
Would you find then that Canada's contribution and all that was the most significant of its contributions during the Cold War?
Not sure. Probably Europe. A true air defender from back in the 50s and 60s would probably disagree with me, because he